It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger. To be
real. Welcome to Jill on Money. It's hour number two. If you've got a financial question, we'd love for you to contact us. So easy to do. Give us a call. Easy. 855-411-JILL. See? Simple. How about an email? Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. And today we have such an exciting, fabulous guest. And the reason is that she is, number one, the kind of guest we love, the kind of person who takes complicated and tough, thorny stuff, boils it down, and just is able to break through. Her name is Kathy O'Neill. She has a book that is called Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy is, by the way, is long listed for the National Book Award. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's just out in paperback. So we thought we would be happy to present an interview with the wonderful Kathy O'Neill. And we start this with a very funny first question. So stay tuned. It's Jill on Money with my interview of Kathy O'Neill. What is the best financial decision or career decision or money decision that you've ever made in your life?
Taking all my money out of the stock market.
Really? When did you do that?
I mean, not at the worst time, but not at a great time, but it just freed me. I just don't think about it anymore.
So you're not invested right now at all?
No, not at all.
It just freaked you out too much?
It distracted me, to be honest.
Wow.
And the truth is, like, I mean, maybe I'm bragging here, but like—
Yeah, you should.
My job is to think. And if I spend my time worrying about the market, I'm not making money thinking. And like, I actually make more money thinking than I would by investing. It's not like I have a lot of money, by the way.
Oh, yeah. We'll look at your balance sheet after. All right. I like that idea because I do like the idea that it can drive you crazy.
It can drive you crazy. I'll tell you what, like I've spent a lot of time with very poor people and with very rich people. And the people who worry the most about money are people at the extremes. The people who are in the middle who are like, I have enough money not to worry about it, but I don't have enough money to worry about it.
There was like an interesting survey about money and happiness. And I think that there was like a sweet spot where they said sort of like $75,000 to $100,000 a year in income was like where they found the happiest people. Because again, I've got my shelter. I've got this. I don't have so much money where I have to really start like freaking out because I'm not going to save a ton of money for my kids' college. And I'm going to just plod along and do my job. But, you know, that goes against my mother's theory, which is rich or poor, it's nice to have money.
Dude, I'm probably going to regret this. I'm probably going to be like, I'm such an idiot. The market is so high. I'm actually probably already feel that way. But instead, I just feel like I don't even have to worry about it.
This is going to be great. So I was teasing myself as I was reading through this, so excited, folding pages down. And I'm reading it. And my girlfriend says to me, honey, you have every single page folded down.
It really
down.
Does almost look that way.
It's a little scary.
It's so extremely flattering.
So it may be flattering, but it's not going to be helpful for this interview. So
you can't go through every single point.
Kathy O'Neill, New York Times bestseller, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. So, Kathy, you are a data scientist. You're a math nerd.
Yeah,
right?
I am. Sure.
Why'd you write this book?
Well, I wrote the book because after my experiences as a quant in finance, because I worked at a hedge fund with Larry Summers, like during the crisis, I left finance sort of disgusted with the way that mathematics was being used and abused. You remember the mortgage-backed securities and the AAA ratings? Well, those AAA ratings were a mathematical lie.
Mm.
And it really upset me that mathematics was the sort of trust in mathematics was being abused. And so many people trusted those AAA ratings. And internationally, people invested in them. And it really screwed up the economy because of an underlying mathematical lie. And I know that's not the whole story. There's a lot of corruption going on. A lot of people should have gone to jail. They didn't. But there was at its heart this sort of dishonesty. And it made me realize that mathematical algorithms, when they are being misrepresented can really have devastating consequences.
Let's back up a second because, okay, I'm a little bit of a math nerd.
Oh, awesome.
So let's go back for the people who are absolutely freaked out by the word math right now who are listening. And let's talk about what is an algorithm and how they can process that. And what's the difference between a good algorithm and a bad one?
I'm glad we're doing that because, like, one of my most important points is, like, you don't need to be a math nerd to understand the kind of corruption and failure I'm talking about. So an algorithm for me is something we actually do in our heads on a daily basis. It's using sort of past information, past data to predict something. So, for example, I like to use the following example. Look, I make dinner for my family. I have three sons and a husband. And I like to make a dinner that would be successful, right? Mm-hmm. And so what is the information I have? Well, how did past dinners go? What did people eat? What did people not eat? How well cooked should this be if I want to get people to eat it, et cetera, like that. So the data coming in is all the past dinners, but also the actual ingredients I have in my kitchen. And I should say that I don't include all the ingredients. And this is already part of how I'm embedding my agenda into that model. So I don't include ramen noodles. That my 17-year-old loves ramen noodles, but I'm like, that's not really food to me, right? I don't consider Jell-O for the most dinners, right? I'm not saying there will be no dinner where I'd have Jell-O, but on an average night, I'm like, no, that's not part of dinner. So I curate my data. And this is one of the most important things, that people always curate the data. They decide what's relevant. Mm-hmm. And that's a very subjective choice. And then I make the dinner, blah, blah, blah. I sit down with my family. We eat. Then afterwards, I look at the dinner and I say, was this successful or not?
You get the feedback probably in real time.
Yes. Except the very important point is that I'm in charge. So I get to decide what success looks like. So I define success to be my kids ate enough and they ate their vegetables.
Okay.
Okay.
Jose, you're that kind of mother.
Because I'm that kind of bitchy mother. I just, the point being that if my 8-year-old were in charge, the definition of success would be, did I get to eat Nutella? Because that's all he cares about, literally. So the point I'm trying to make, though, is that the definition of success matters crucially, because I will make the next meal depending on whether this meal was successful. Mm-hmm. I'll make the next meal like this meal in some way, right? And if I had chosen the Nutella definition of success, it would be a very different sequence of meals. Mm-hmm. But I'm in charge.
And you get to make that determination. You get to filter what comes back at you in terms of the feedback.
Exactly. Yep. I get to decide what's important, what's not, what a failure looks like, how much to penalize myself for a failure, et cetera. So going back to finance, the AAA rated mortgage-backed security credit ratings, they decided what kind of data to use. They didn't have any of the relevant data. So they just used old data that looked good. It was the wrong thing to do. But their definition of success wasn't that AAA rated mortgage-backed securities never defaulted. Their definition of success was they got more market share. They got paid.
Right. We got paid by the client. They sold more of this stuff. It's highly unlikely that this whole series of events would be. I don't even know if they thought about the downside when they were doing it.
I don't think they did. I think they literally were just so greedy and dishonest that they were like, oh, well, it's working as long as the machine keeps turning.
We'll be back with our interview of Kathy O'Neill in just a moment. Remember, if you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Ask Jill at JillOnMoney.com. That's our email address. You can always send us a note there or follow us on Twitter at JillOnMoney. We'll be right back.
It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 65, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Back to Jill on Money.
You're back with Jill on Money, and we are very fortunate to have a special guest here. It's so great to have Kathy O'Neill. Her book is called Weapons of Math Destruction. And again, I cannot emphasize enough how important it is that we understand the types of things that are being used about us and the way that math, you think it's just science, it's fact, it's an equation, but there are a lot of variables and there's human beings that are involved with picking which variables will be used for any formula or algorithm. that's why it's really important to try to get down to the bottom of this, also to understand how the most recent crisis, which is almost 10 years old, how that actually occurred. Our guest Kathy O'Neill weighs in. The thing that freaked me out about that period of time as someone who kind of digs statistics and like old time options traders, that I would talk to people on Wall Street. So, you know, I was still managing money then, and I would talk to some people I knew that were like institutional people, and I would say things like, but I don't understand, and fill in the blank. It would just be a normal question. Right. Like, well, what happens if, well, that's not going to happen. It's never happened before. But a lot of things that have never happened before happen. So have you modeled that? And they would, I think maybe they were more of the salespeople or the trader types who would say, but the guys in the quants tell us everything's fine. So they relied on math to make themselves feel better. Mm-hmm. But did they ever ask those questions, or were they so blinded by the money?
I think it's a little of both, but I'll say as one of those quants, because that's what I did, like I asked stupid questions too, and the other quants were like, don't ask stupid questions.
Oh, really?
But you're absolutely right, and I think that's a very important point, which is that a lot of this belief system, which it really was a belief system, was propped up by the underlying authority of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I left finance thinking, that's nasty. Like, I'm a believer in mathematics. Mathematics is powerful and beautiful and true. This isn't mathematics. This is something else. This is marketing or something along those lines. And it is actually obscuring truth rather than clarifying.
Tell me an example of a good algorithm that's like, oh my God, that works. Tell me the beauty of math. Get people psyched about an algorithm that works, that you think is like, oh man, that's awesome.
I think my favorite use of math and prediction is probably from sports. I mean, I just think it's really cool to come up with different ways of measuring sports players and like how are they valuable to the team? How do they contribute to a win? Because it's important to know that there's very specialized. Sports is very specialized in a few ways. First of all, it's very clear what you're going for, and that's winning. Remember,
right,
we were talking about like the definition of success for cooking?
Right.
In this realm, it's pretty clear what you're going for. You want your team to win. And maybe you're, it's actually, you should think you wanted to win the World Series if you're in baseball instead of winning a specific game. But it's pretty much the same thing on mm-hmm. a daily basis. The second thing that's really special about sports, besides that it's really fun and entertaining, is that you get feedback. And this is something, after I left finance, I went to data science, I saw a really problematic series of algorithms that don't get this critical feedback. In other words, in sports, if you have underestimated the potential of a player and you don't pick him up on your team and it goes to another team, then you'll see you made a mistake.
Right, because that feedback is continuing whether or not that person's with you or not. And in baseball, you have 162 games, so it's even better than football, which is 16 games.
Right, right. Baseball is obviously my favorite sport.
So a good algorithm, a good use of algorithm, sports.
Yes.
Now let's talk
Here's
about...
Here's another one.
Yeah.
Amazon.
Amazon
does an amazing, amazing job. And again, it's about a feedback loop, right?
Huge numbers, right? And you get that information constantly.
Constantly. And they say, oh, you're the type of person who might like baby rattles, you know, and they'll show me a product and I'm like, I don't want that. And they'll show not just to me, but to people like me, and it doesn't work. And guess what the machine does? It says, that didn't work. Let's not do that anymore. And so instead they show me stuff that I actually want. And by the way, I'm not saying like Amazon's my favorite company, because I'm actually really scared of Amazon taking over the world and having an enormous amount of power. But I do want to say they do big data really well.
What about Netflix?
Netflix, I like.
That's pretty interesting, right?
It's interesting. I love the technical details of recommendation engines. It's really fun. I mean, it's not perfect, because think about it. Like, some populations watch way more movies and they rate more movies. And
right,
that information means, because they are overrepresented, that means like recommendation engine is going to work a lot better for them than for me. And when I say them, I'm talking about my teenage sons.
Of course.
So the recommendation engine is tilted towards people who use it more. But that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I guess.
But it means that they know me less. And by the way, I don't hate algorithms. I worry about algorithms that are potentially very harmful. And the thing you can say about Netflix is the worst harm that can come to you is that you watch a movie you don't like. It's just not that big a deal.
Right. So let's talk about the scary ones. And you start the book with a few of them. So I love this part where you say there will always be mistakes, because models are, by their very nature, simplifications. No model can include all of the real world's complexity or the nuance of human communication. To create a model, then, we make choices about what's important enough to include, simplifying the world into a toy version that can be easily understood and from which we can infer important facts and actions. Now, what struck me about that is when you're trying to model something with variables that aren't exactly measurable, right? The qualitative, not the quantitative, that seems to me where you run into some of the biggest problems. So can you talk a little bit about the teacher evaluations, which is the one that just jumps out and is horrifying to me?
It is horrifying. And by the way, it's still being used.
Yeah, I know.
So the idea is hold teachers accountable. Well, if you're going to hold teachers accountable, if you're going to get rid of bad teachers, you're going to have to define which teachers are bad. So if you think about it, like what makes a teacher a good teacher? And the answer that they came up with was, let's just look at test scores. Now, you and I both know that a good teacher isn't defined by their test scores. It's defined by whether they inspire or whether they include everyone or making sure they don't shame anyone. There's all sorts of ways you could be a good or a bad teacher. Test scores is the only information they really take in about a given teacher.
Is that because it's the only quantitative data that you can grab? It's the easiest.
It's easiest. Right. I think it's just literally like, let's close our eyes and hope this works type of stuff. And it doesn't work because what they've come up with is almost a random number generator. For each student in a person's class, so if you have 30 students, you have 30 kids, each of them comes in at the beginning of your fourth grade year with an expected end of year score on their standardized tests. It's based partly on their end of third grade score. Also, which class they're in, which teacher they have, which school they're in, which school system they're in, how many kids are in the class, how many kids qualify for a free school lunch, which is a proxy for poverty. Mm-hmm. Complicated formula, but essentially what they're expected to get at the end of the year. And it's not a very good model. It's not very accurate. Imagine you trying to figure out, just knowing what a kid got at the end of the school year and looking around the school, like trying to figure out what they're going to get at the end of next year. In a year, that's hard to predict. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it's pretty uncertain. And then they compare for your 30 students. They all come up with the expected score. They compare it with the actual scores your kids get. So if somebody was expected to get a 50, but they got a 60, you'd been give credit for that. So you get credit or you're penalized for the difference between their actual and expected scores. So if you raised everyone's score 10 points above expected, then you would obviously be a magnificent teacher. That's typically not what happens. But also, very importantly, the idea is that only you and only you are responsible for the difference between these two numbers. But actually, these two numbers are extremely uncertain. You would think your actual score of an actual kid would be just a number. But think about it. If you took it on a different day, or if you got less sleep that day, or if it was a hot day and you didn't have air conditioning, or you did have air conditioning, lots of different variables, or you had it after lunch and you didn't eat lunch, you know, lots of variables could just change the actual score a kid gets in a given test.
Mm-hmm.
Or the test itself could be harder that year than expected,
mm-hmm.
which happens all the time.
Hmm.
So you have two numbers. You're taking the difference. They're both uncertain. The difference is actually more uncertain. And the end result is that teachers are being scored on sort of the average of 30 very random numbers. And that means that the teacher scores themselves are almost random.
We'll get back to our interview with Kathy O'Neill in just a second. Hey, during the break, go buy her book, Weapons of Math Destruction. It's available in paperback. And you can also go to our website, jillonmoney.com. Check out our blog posts, check out TV segments, everything, anything that Mark feels like putting up. 855-411-JILL is our phone number. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. That's our email address. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
That's life.
That's love.
That's what all the people
You're
say.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. And we are so lucky because we are talking with Kathy O'Neill. She is the author of the fantastic book, Weapons of Math Destruction. So easy to read. It's amazing to read someone who can break down complicated things like algorithms in a way that we can all understand. So check it out in paperback. You know, you may think about algorithms as something that's used to create financial products or to quantify risk. But you know what? They're also used in our nation's school systems. That's what Kathy tells us. There is a story in the book that you tell of one New York City school teacher where one year, I think it was like a 6 and the other was 90 or something.
96.
What?
Yes. I know. And he didn't change the way he taught. I mean, his conclusion, which was appropriate, was this system doesn't make any sense.
Oh, my God.
He was allowed to make that because he already had tenure, and this wasn't about getting fired. Whereas Sarah Wysocki, who I profiled at the beginning of the book, did get fired. She got fired based on her overall teacher assessment, 50% of which was her value-added model score. This is what I've been describing, the mm-hmm. value-added model, which was extremely bad. And she thought about it, and she said, you know, a lot of the kids that were in my fourth grade class had gotten really high scores at the end of third grade, but came in and didn't know how to read or write. Okay, that's very strange, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was under Michelle Rhee, a superintendent in Washington, D.C.
The now disgraced.
Yes, I would say. She not only fired people like Sarah for getting bad scores, she also gave bonuses for really good scores.
So people fudge their numbers.
I mean, there are certainly incentives.
Mm-hmm.
And the school that those kids came from, they had an unusual number of erasures, but nobody really investigated. So we had, at least Sarah had, plenty of evidence to suspect that her score was being artificially deflated by previous cheating.
Hmm.
Because think about it. If teachers had cheated on those tests, they came in with inflated expected scores, and Sarah couldn't possibly make up the difference,
mm-hmm.
right? She tried to appeal her score, but she was told that the process was fair based on it being a mathematical algorithm.
But they didn't open that up. It wasn't a transparent model.
It wasn't at all transparent. And that's, I'm going to just come to the definition for me of mm-hmm. a weapon of math destruction,
mm-hmm.
which is a powerful, highly scaled, secret and destructive algorithm.
Mm.
And that's what this value-added model became, right? It was powerful. It was being used to fire people in an entire school system. And it's actually being used, it was at the time at least, being used in more than half of the states, usually in urban school districts. It is secret. Nobody understands it, including, by the way, most of the people in the school systems themselves. They were being made in these little tiny like think tanky places and sold to the school systems with a license saying like you'll never see this formula. So even the superintendent of schools couldn't understand the formula.
And if you think that, you know, weapons of math destruction are not pertinent to your life, it's not just your shopping and it's not just your teaching, but we're also talking about, and in the book you go into this, policing and incarceration. So mm-hmm. talk about that, because that to me is where, like, oh my God, the real life, I mean, it's terrible this woman lost her job. The next bad iteration of this yeah. really feels pretty awful to me.
This is a huge, huge thing. And mostly, if you read about it in the media, you'll see it touted as like scientific policing.
Right.
Right.
Like targeted.
Yes. And this, again, for me, is like an abuse of the authority of mathematics. Like, we should trust math. We shouldn't trust mathematical algorithms because, again, you curate the data and you define success. So the first sort of realm of algorithms being used in the justice system are predictive policing algorithms. And they basically say, look at the sort of location of previous arrests. And then they say, let's predict the next crime based on the location of previous arrests. The difference between where crimes happen and where arrests happen is very, very large.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people don't really think about this, but most crimes don't lead to arrests, especially drug crimes.
Right.
But in some places, they really do, much more often anyway. So what's happened is, because of the data, the arrests are happening where we've been doing broken windows policing, where we've been sort of putting lots and lots of police in poor minority neighborhoods. And we are finding those low-level crimes because that was the point of broken windows policing under Bloomberg and stop and frisk. That was the point of it. So the data will tell us, go back there. That's where the crimes are occurring. The thought experiment I like to do around this, which I think you'll enjoy, is what if after the crisis, cops were sent down to Wall Street to arrest all the bankers? And because, you know, there's where the crime is.
Mm-hmm.
If they had done that, then the data we have would be very different. It would say, oh, go back to Wall Street. That's where the crime is. Let's go look for crime over there. It's not what we just chose to do as a society. But that sort of brings up the real point, which is that we are just as much predicting our society as we are predicting crime.
I mean, I kind of liked it more when we were talking about baseball, I got to tell you. This is definitely sobering. Is there a way to build a better algorithm to do what they're trying to do? Could you create such a algorithm for either teachers or policing that you think is a fairer way to try to do what they're trying to do?
So with teachers, I don't know how to do it, but I will tell you how I would test anything. If I were asked to build something, I wouldn't accept what I've built until it agrees closely with a qualitative assessment of teachers that we can agree on. So the whole sort of the genesis of the FAST teacher ability assessment was that, yes, we could assess teachers qualitatively, but it's very expensive and it doesn't scale. Well, my argument would be we have to make sure that whatever we come up with agrees with that qualitative assessment before we try scaling it. As far as the policing thing goes, it's really tricky because what big data models do is they propagate the past. They repeat patterns because that's what algorithms are good at. They're picking up historical patterns and repeating them. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to repeat our past policing patterns? Or do we want to really change the way we do policing? My feeling personally is we would probably want to rethink it. And if we rethink it, then the data we get out of it will look very different.
Mm.
Now, if we really changed policing and we kept it different, then an algorithm built on that kind of data would look different. And maybe that would be a good way to go. But I think right now the data is so painfully biased against poor minority neighborhoods that I don't know how to fix that.
We'll get back to our interview with Kathy O'Neill in just a minute. If you would like to talk to us, give us a holler, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Want to get in touch? Call or email any day, anytime. 855-411-JILL or askjill@jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money, and today we've got a special guest, Kathy O'Neill. Her book, Weapons of Math Destruction, it's fantastic. It's out in paperback. And as you might imagine, with all the information about Equifax and credit scores and credit reports in the news, we cover that ground. Here's my interview with Kathy O'Neill. Also in the book, you talk about using algorithms and how they're incorporated with things that we encounter every day in the financial world, like your credit score,
yep,
as well as maybe insurance
Absolutely.
Sales. So let me just start with the credit score, because people really do get wrapped around the axle about their credit scores. And I think that, you know, when I first entered the financial planning business, no one talked about a credit score. Like when you got a mortgage, someone talked a tiny bit about credit, but mostly you're walking into your banker and saying,
yeah,
here's how much money I made. Here's my tax returns. What do I get?
Yeah.
So talk about the evolution of how algorithms have changed the credit system right now.
Great. I mean, and this is such a sobering story, actually. So it was actually part of the women's lib movement that they noticed, especially divorced women, had a lot of trouble getting any credit whatsoever from their local banker. Because as you say, the bankers would look you up and down, ask you for papers. If all you could provide was stuff that happened when you were married, like bankers just didn't give it credit to women for that. And that was a problem. And this was sort of around the same time as the civil rights movement. So policymakers actually responded to this and said, you know what? It should not be legal to base creditworthiness on a gender. And then at the end, they put in race either. It really upended the loan business for small bankers. And they were like, what? How are we going to figure out who's creditworthy? In response to this, the FICO score was born. People think of this as like an awful thing, but actually FICO scores, they were created in response to this law as a way of sort of letting banks continue with the process of loans, saying like, these are by construction legal. They do not use race. They do not use gender. And you can use them to decide who to give a loan to. And of course, bankers loved it because it was much easier for them. And it allowed them to scale their loans actually much, much higher. And that's one of the reasons we've seen so many more credit cards, because FICO scores made it so much easier for everyone to think about loaning to each other. It was very sanitary. It was like sanitized the whole process.
By the way, so it made me feel a little bit better reading the book about Fair Isaac as like just as an organization, even though I think that credit scores are just overblown in terms of like what they've come to mean.
But absolutely. I would argue that the credit scores, as a way of deciding who's creditworthy, are actually pretty good because they're based on, let's recall, they're based on like your actual ability to pay your electricity bill.
Your history.
Your history of paying your bills, which right. I think everyone would agree with is a fair
yeah.
measure. What's wrong with it is that they're being used to decide whether you can perform at a job.
Right. Get an apartment even.
Get an apartment or even have a date. And the reason, of course, that's so bad is because if you've lost your job and then you've been unemployed for a while, your credit score is inevitably beginning to go down. So it makes it harder to get that job. You're starting to see a pattern. The people who are unlucky become more unlucky. The people who are lucky get luckier. I'm not trying to say that I should be in charge of ethics. I'm very progressive. I'm not representative, right? I'm saying we need to have an ethical conversation separate from an algorithm. And we can't just say this algorithm is inherently fair and objective. It's simply not. It is subjective. And we need to understand the subjectivity.
Tell me about insurance, because we, by the way, get a gazillion questions about insurance on the program here.
I think the easiest case to make that insurance and big data is really essentially incompatible is health insurance. We have no idea what's going on with health insurance in this country, so let me scare you.
Great. Everyone prepare to hang on.
So the underlying concept of insurance is pretty simple. We're a village. Let's just say we have a 1,000-person village, right? When people get sick, they go to the doctor and they spend their entire life savings getting well. And they're broke afterwards. So their life is ruined. And it's an awful tragedy for those people. And we keep seeing this happen. And eventually someone comes up with a smart idea. They say, let's pool our resources. Let's all, like once a month, put in an affordable amount of money into this big urn. And someone is going to get paid a little bit to protect the urn, right? And then when somebody gets sick, they can take money out of the urn to pay for their insurance.
Okay.
They pay for their doctors. Mm-hmm. And they won't end up like a defeated, broken person.
Right.
Okay. That is insurance. It's pooled risk.
Right.
The idea being put in an affordable amount of money every month instead of having an unaffordable amount of money expected you have at a specific terrible time.
Right.
Now introduce big data. What does big data do? Big data allows us to profile and segregate and silo every single person based on their risk.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody who's pretty sick or about to be sick is going to be charged way more than somebody who seems like they're not sick at all and they're not going to get sick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, there's all sorts of things that are totally unpredictable, like breaking your leg. And by the way, I should say that like those algorithms, those AI, really, that's learning about our future health risks could be invaluable tools for our doctors. Mm. If our doctors see what we're at risk of and help us prevent those illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
But in the hands of insurance companies, what do? They just silo you off, say you're in a high risk pool, you're in a low risk pool. Oh, good news, low risk people. And they always frame it as good news,
yeah.
always.
Great
good
news.
Good news, your premiums have just gone down. In the world of market competition among insurance companies, it's simple. What they're trying to do is get rid of all the sick people and lower the premiums as much as possible on the healthy people, which is to say get only really, really healthy people. And the asymptotic limit of this, as a nerd, I have to say that every now and then.
I love that word.
Is insurance for people who don't need it and no insurance for people who need it.
Mm.
We have defeated the purpose of pooled risk if we get rid of everybody who's risky.
Thanks again to Kathy O'Neill. What a wonderful interview. Go out and buy her book, Weapons of Math Destruction. It's available in paperback. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, send an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, just give us a holler. It's so easy to get in touch with us. 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow us on Twitter @JillOnMoney. Mark, we hit 14,000. Did you notice? Finally. You want 15,000 by the end of the year? That seems reasonable. I think that's okay. I like that. If you've missed any part of the show or you didn't quite catch all of the Kathy O'Neill interview, don't forget that you can go to our YouTube channel. Actually, forget that. Just go to JillOnMoney.com. Mark put a beautiful link right up on top to the YouTube channel. And you can listen to the earlier part of the interview and past interviews and past shows. It's all great. So just do that. Go to JillOnMoney.com and you will see all the information you need. Okay, a couple weeks ago, we had a question from a caller. And we got a response to that. The subject of this email that we received from B in Springfield, Missouri, and the subject was $2.2 million. A few days ago, I heard your radio broadcast about the gentleman who had his Social Security, two military pensions, and didn't know what to do with all that. He also had the $2.2 million. B says, I've had a checking account since I was 8 years old, worked till now, age 59. And I never thought I would feel such sadness for a fellow with that sort of a problem. Dripping with sarcasm. I love this so much. It's funny. There are so many kids who would benefit from technical training. How about scholarships to micro WeWorks to something like that? Anyway, how about scholarships to do that? Give him a hug from me. I know. We felt the same way, but, you know, look, what can I say? That's one of those weird calls where, you know, the guy's just, he was so stressed out about taxes. We had a few questions over the last month or so where people were so upset about taxes. And I'm like, oh, my God, but you have all this money. Anyway, that was a great show. Thank you all for listening. Don't forget to go buy Kathy O'Neill's book, Weapons of Math Destruction. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, ask Jill at JillOnMoney.com, and say hi to Mark and tell him we need some new music. All right, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.